This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The federal government, the TUC and the NLC, to establish a joint committee to review the proposal for any wage increase or award and establish a framework and timeline for implementation.
That's the Speaker of Nigeria's House of Representatives, Femi Gbajabiamila, on meetings with the Nigeria Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress to avert a strike over fuel prices. Details coming up. Also, Yemi Mobaleda, Nigerian immigrant, becomes a history-making mayor in the U.S. state of Colorado today, and there is a call to build sustainable cities with affordable housing. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. A short time ago, in the western U.S. city of Colorado Springs, Yemi Mobaleda made history as he became the first black mayor of the city. The new mayor, an immigrant from Nigeria, also the first in the city's history, who isn't a member of the Republican Party. Mobaleda, who co-founded two restaurants and served in the local government to advise small businesses, ran as an independent. Reporter Haruna Shahu with VOA's Hausa service is in Colorado Springs to attend the swearing-in ceremony. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with him a short time ago as the ceremony was wrapping up.
It's a very beautiful day here. It's sunny and very dry. A lot of people have gathered here at the Pioneers Museum where the inauguration of the first elected black mayor is taking place. Thousands of people have gathered here. You can see the smiles in their faces. And, you know, so many people in attendance, as I said, including the state governor, who is a Democrat. He's here, and there are some former elected officials. The outgoing mayor is here also. The governor has delivered a speech promising to work with the new mayor here, even though they are not on the same political party. And also, the outgoing mayor also praised Yemi Mobaleda, and, you know, hoping that he is going to meet the city very well.
Now, Mr. Mobaleda has an interesting background. Can you describe a little bit of how he wound up in a city in the western state of Colorado?
So, Yemi is an immigrant from Nigeria. He came to the United States in 1996. About 27 years ago now, as a student. He came here to pursue his academic, just like his brother. And in 2010, he moved to Colorado Springs. He's a business guy. He co-founded two restaurants here. He also founded a church. But then while also running his businesses, he was also working with the city council as the business development manager. Which is a role that has actually, you know, got him very closer to the people here. So he is a business guy. And, you know, coming from Nigeria, the lessons that he learned, you know, going up in Nigeria, the lack of opportunities back in Nigeria have helped him here when he comes, when he sees an opportunity here, he just goes there to grab it. So he's is an interesting story for many immigrants, from especially from Africa.
You had an interview with him, and he spoke at length about the messages he wants to share with residents of the city and voters. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Even in his inaugural speech here, he reverberated, he repeated, you know, such messages that he was giving to people. First of all, he said his electoral victory is an indication that people are yearning for a different kind of leadership, a new type of leadership that transcends party lines, race, ethnicity. People are now looking for leadership that is going to impact their life positively. That is one. And then two, he also spoke about the opportunities here, that if you want to see change, it's not for you to sit on the fence. You get to be involved, and then there are opportunities here. It's not that you are an immigrant you can't do this. No, there is a lot of opportunities here for everyone. And, you know, he said his victory, he hopes, will encourage more people, will empower more people to also realize that they have a place in American politics. They have a role to play in moving this great nation forward.
Nigeria's main labor groups, the Nigeria Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress, agreed to suspend their strike scheduled to begin tomorrow over President Bola Tinubu's decision to end the fuel subsidy. Our reporter from Abuja tells us more.
Labor groups say they called off the strike to protest the end of the government's fuel subsidy to enable further negotiations with the federal government. The decision came at the end of the meeting late Monday evening. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, Femi Badjabiamila, chaired the meeting with the Nigeria Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress. He said a tripartite committee would be set up to review the wage increase the labour unions are demanding. He said the committee also would review the $800 million World Bank loan to Nigeria to ease the impact of the fuel subsidy, especially for low-income workers.
The federal government, the TUC and the NLC, to establish a joint committee to review the proposal for any wage increase or award and establish a framework and timeline for implementation. The federal government, the TUC and the NLC, to review World Bank Finance Cash Transfer Scheme and propose inclusion of low-income earners in the program.
He said all other demands submitted by the TUC to the federal government will be assessed by the joint committee. In a related event, the National Industrial Court in Abuja on Monday restrained the Nigeria Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress from embarking on their planned strike. The two labour groups had planned to strike starting Wednesday until their demands were met. The Trade Union Congress met with government representatives on Sunday and demanded a new minimum wage to ease the effects of the removal of the subsidy, but was silent on the figure. Although Nigeria is a major oil producer, it does not refine enough oil for consumer use, so it must import fuel for vehicles and other uses. The government subsidy on consumer fuel prices costs billions of dollars a year and led to warnings from economists, the World Bank and others that it could not be sustained. When President Tinubu said last week the subsidy would end, prices more than doubled, hitting consumers hard in an economy already burdened with inflation and high unemployment. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
As you just heard, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu said the subsidy on fuel has been removed. He said on the day of his inauguration that there is no provision for subsidy on fuel in the 2023 budget. The announcement led to surge in prices of fuel, leading to increasing costs for transportation, food and some services. Some Nigerians say it has not been easy coping with the surge in fuel prices. They spoke to reporter Mike Mbonier.
My name is Annabelle Mary, and I'm a graduate job hunting. Actually, this subsidy has become something else to me personally, because since the increment of the price of fuel, it has become very, very critical for people to move around, do their daily activities. And the stress alone is way too much for us, considering the atmospheric condition. Personally, at times, I find it difficult to go to some places because of the increment in the price of fuel, and thereby affecting other people's activities. Because the tax drivers, they have increased the price of the taxes or the price of things while going out, especially when you want to go and buy something in the market. You find out that the price of things as of last week or last 2 weeks are way too bigger than the price of things today. And it's affecting us out and the lives of the society. I think if actually the price of the fuel will be reduced, I think we'll have to move forward in this country as a society.
My name is Augustine Dodo, and I'm a bus driver. Mm-hmm. And we buy fuel for 500, some cases 550, and still yet you don't make, maybe you buy fuel for 5,000 naira, what you make is 6,000 naira. You buy fuel for 5,000, you are making 6,000 naira.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. The price, if we say we are carrying for 500 or 400, some people can't even afford it. If you stand and you can't get passenger, you have to load with what they have. And it's affecting both the bus driver and the passengers too.
Okay, I'm Ola Olu. I'm a fashion designer. So most times when we go to work, you know, when we get to the bus stop, you know, the prices of transport now has gone high. And then when we get to the bus stop, we wait until we see a driver that will consider us, because getting the fuel now is now high. So we know it is not easy. It's affecting all sector. Even when we go to the market, the price has changed. You know, we go to the market and they'll buy things so expensively. That's it.
My name is Sarah Otegbayo. I'm into bad business. It affects the business, seriously. No customer. People that normally come after working, if they're coming from work, they normally come. They didn't come again because of the fuel. So even though what you are buying in the market now is very expensive, so it affects us. Everywhere is dry. They should do something about it. Oh, that 500 naira is on the high side. They should do something about it. If there is any way they can do something, please, they should do it fast. It's affecting so many people. Honestly.
Those were the views of some Nigerians on the surge in fuel prices. They spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos, Nigeria. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire in Sudan to be followed by a permanent halt to hostilities and fresh efforts to reach a lasting democratic political settlement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington remains committed to ensuring peace in Sudan, but the two warring sides showed no commitment to stop the fighting. Numerous previous ceasefire agreements were violated. Amar Hamzwa, director of Carnegie Middle East Program, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi about what is behind the continued conflict in Sudan.
The first one is historically older than recent tensions, older than the democratic uprising in 2018, which launched at least an attempt to create democratic governance in Sudan. The first layer is centered around tensions between central government in Khartoum, its ruling establishment, its elite, no matter we're referring to civilian forces or military security forces, on the one hand, and on the other hand, different regions which are populated by non-Arabs ethnically, majority-wise, and which are populated by non-Muslims in terms of their religious affiliation. These tensions have, in fact, dominated Sudan's political development since the 1950s, since Sudan's independence, early 50s. The second layer, which is more related to the current environment, is the fact that Sudan, and it's a residual of former President Omar al-Bashir's policies and practices, Sudan has been suffering from a duality in the armed forces. An army, a professional army, has existed for a long time alongside paramilitary troops. So what's happening right now is a convergence of these two layers, leading to civil war-like situations, not only in Khartoum and Umm Durman, but even in remote regions. And it's a scramble for influence, for representation, for social and economic gains. And therefore, ceasefire arrangements and agreements are not kicking in up until now.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan announced U.S. economic sanctions on Sudan's warring generals. What else could convince the two sides to agree to a ceasefire and to start negotiations to settle the conflict in Sudan?
As long as each side believes that it could deal the opposing side a military defeat, the war will not stop and military operations will not stop. It's only when they come to realize that they can not deal their adversaries a decisive military defeat, that they would start taking negotiating tables and negotiations more seriously in the sense of agreeing to binding arrangements and binding stipulations. But as we know from different civil war situations, even previous ones in Sudan, Sudan lived in a civil war between its government in the north and the south for over four decades until the Republic of South Sudan was created in end of 2011, beginning of 2012. Civil wars have an intrinsic logic into them. They perpetuate themselves by creating new elites, by creating new groups which are benefiting, new beneficiaries socially, economically, and politically, and their scramble and strive toward ultimate power continues as long as they do not realize that they cannot defeat their adversaries decisively in the battlefield. Unfortunately, the battlefield will continue.
Amir Hamzawi, director of Carnegie Middle East Program, he was speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Chinawi. Participants at a high-level UN conference in Nairobi are calling for sustainable urban development to create better cities and transform the lives of urban residents around the world. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama has the story.
The second session of the UN Habitat Assembly is now officially open, and I thank you.
About 4,500 delegates, including ministers, government officials, and representatives from civil society organizations, are gathering in Nairobi this week for the second session of the UN Habitat Assembly. The meeting, which runs through Friday, June 9th, will deliberate on universal access to affordable housing and how cities can better re-emerge from crisis. Leslie Kendi, a student from the University of Nairobi, is among the participants.
Housing in the cities in Africa, especially Nairobi, since I live in Nairobi, is a huge problem. Some people don't even have houses, first of all. You see people living under the bridge. Others have houses, but I wouldn't say they pass off as houses. If you'd see it, you wouldn't think it's a house. It's not healthy, it's not a good environment for them. And others live in really good places.
The theme of the assembly is a sustainable urban future through inclusive and effective multilateralism, achieving the sustainable development goals in times of global crisis. Maimona Mohamed Sharif is the UN Habitat Executive Director.
The reality is that impact of extreme climate events, conflicts, natural disasters, global pandemic, and the cost of living crisis are felt first and foremost in cities. Those of us from humble beginnings understand how adequate housing and urbanization can deliver a better quality of life.
Kenyan President William Ruto addressed the gathering on Monday. He challenged countries to stand united to address the growing urban population and housing problem.
For better or for worse, the world population has reached 8 billion people, 57% of whom live in urban areas. These numbers are expected to increase steadily in the coming years, but urban populations are projected to rise even faster. In the global south, the rates will be even more pronounced.
The World Bank says more than 4 billion people, just over half the world's population, live in cities. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The South African government says a six-member team of leaders from the continent will head to Russia and Ukraine in mid-June on a peace mission to end the war in Eastern Europe. Spokespeople for President Cyril Ramaphosa told VOA the team set to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev as a starting point. Darren Taylor reports.
The South African president's representatives say he's in regular contact with Putin and Zelensky about the African peace mission. They say Ramaphosa, plus the leaders of Egypt, Republic of Congo, Senegal, Uganda, and Zambia, are going to draw up a roadmap toward ending the Ukraine war. The African leaders met Monday and said their first objective would be to secure a ceasefire and thereafter a lasting peace in the region. John Stremlau is a former United States diplomat to several African countries and currently Professor of International Relations at Wits University in Johannesburg. He says Africa has a vested interest in stopping the war in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The real concern that should be uppermost in our mind is getting a peaceful resolution of this god-awful crisis that is causing such devastation and so much human suffering, and then the collateral damage to Africa in grain exports here and fuel and other commodities that are driving our inflation that is so bad.
Stremlau says it's very interesting but not surprising that it appears as if South Africa is leading the peace mission. The African National Congress, the ANC government, has faced global criticism for its close ties with Moscow and refusal to condemn Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Even as the war has raged, South Africa has hosted the Russian Navy for joint military exercises and dispatched its top army general to the Kremlin to discuss military cooperation. The United States has accused the Ramaphosa administration of selling weapons to Russia. Pretoria says it's investigating the allegation. Given this context, some analysts say it's difficult to imagine Ukraine regarding the African peace mission as impartial. At a media briefing Tuesday, South Africa's Deputy Minister of International Relations, Alvin Buertas, said it's because of Africa's neutrality that the peace initiative has a chance of success.
We have heard even President Zelensky, President Putin, welcome any intervention on de-escalation, and that is our departure point. So these peace missions from the African continent indeed are welcome. And we wish.
Puerto says the African mediation team wants to help end the fighting for the sake of the entire world, not just for Africa.
I think the issues about this war in Europe after the COVID-19 pandemic have brought us in a situation where economies worldwide have lost traction. There's increased food insecurity, increased poverty. So I think we are hopeful and we are confident that the peace envoys ultimately will enable the de-escalation of conflict.
In a recent interview with South African State Television, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said her government welcomed any peace initiative aimed at ending the conflict in Eastern Europe. But she attached one non-negotiable condition, that every country involved in the talks understands that Russia is the aggressor. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
An ancient human cousin may have buried its dead and carved symbols into cave walls, surprising findings for a creature with a small brain. Scientists found the fossil remains of the species named Homo naledi in underground caves in South Africa a decade ago. Researchers say they found evidence that the species was capable of complex behavior that so far has only been seen in those with bigger brains. Anthropologist Lee Berger led the research funded by the National Geographic Society. He says it is a remarkable discovery for a species with brains one-third the size of humans. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul Rahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.